This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. Well, we're here, Tammy Flanagan and I, Tammy, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, Weekly GovExec Columnist, knower of all things federal. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
Thanks for coming. And me, I'm Bob Lines. I'm an accountant, tax, finance type, and we're going to talk about, I guess, both sides. We're going to talk about federal benefits as they relate to processing retirement, phased retirement, TSP millionaires, Medicare B, and we're going to talk about some tax issues. We'll talk about the new MIRA, M-Y-R-A, which is short for My IRA. We'll talk a little bit about tax brackets, not too much, and we'll try to play tennis with this. So if you don't mind, let's just throw the ball on your side, Tammy.
Okay.
How long does it take to process retirement now?
Boy, yeah, that's been a question that's been on a lot of people's minds for the last few years. As we've seen, there's been some substantial backlogs with retirement processing. And I think part of the reason for that, or probably the main reason for that, is that retirement processing in 2014 is still a paper-based system. So what happens is when the employee fills out their civil service or their FERS retirement application, they turn it into their benefits office at the agency where they work. And typically you would do that 30 days, in bigger agencies 60 or 90 days before you retire. And all that time before your retirement date, your agency has processing to do. They have to print out all the papers from your official personnel folder that are now stored electronically, but they actually have to print them. And they have to get all the records of your insurance, your beneficiary designations, anything that's going to help OPM see what kind of career you've had and what health insurance and life insurance coverages that you'll be carrying into retirement. So there's some time that's involved on the agency end as far as putting together that package and then ultimately paying your last paycheck, paying out your lump sum annual leave check. And that all happens right after you retire. Usually within the first 30 to 60 days after you retire, you should be finished with the agency. So now this whole thing goes to OPM. Usually within 2 weeks of your separation, OPM will get the retirement package. Now, I have had a lady just recently I talked to who retired December 31st, and she's already got her first full retirement check. She never got one interim check. So it was like, wow. You know, February 1st, she got everything right on time, which is very unusual. Even in the good old days, it never happened that fast on a regular basis. So some of you might have that fortunate experience that everything went smooth and somehow it got on somebody's desk who was able to process it, you know, right away. But more often than not, it's going to take 2 or 3 months, sometimes 4 or 5 months, and on a rare occasion, 6 to 12 months to process your retirement. What determines the length of time is going to be how complicated your case is, how long it took it to get out of the agency is another thing. It can also be the person who gets your case. Did they have leave scheduled? Are they backlogged further than the guy next to them? So there's a lot of different factors. Even the fact if you've been divorced and now has to go to a court order section to be further processed beyond just your regular retirement. So there's a lot of moving parts that can influence the length of time it's going to take. So as I've said for many years with this, you know, plan on the worst, but expect the best. And, you know, so therefore, you know, have some money in the bank to hold you over because those interim checks are not the full amount of what you're going to get. So if you're in interim pay status, you might only be getting 80%, in some cases as little as 50% of your expected retirement. So during that time, you have to fall back on your savings or maybe that lump sum annual leave check. Or worst case scenario, take a TSP withdrawal to get you through those first few months of waiting for the final payment. So it varies because of all that.
If I was to step back and look at this theoretically, let me ask you a question. It's the same question, two different phraseologies. First one is, what would be the profile of somebody that may not require a lot of time. In other words, if somebody's same career, same agency, I won't say same desk and room, but with maybe no baggage, if you will, of a divorce, et cetera, are they going to get processed quicker than somebody?
That helps. That helps because someone who's been at the same place for 35 years, you know, no divorces, no breaks in service, no refunds, you know, that's going to make that a much easier case to process for someone at OPM. But the other thing is, where are you retiring from? How quickly is your agency going to get that whole case over to OPM? Some agencies do a lot of this submission electronically. Some of them don't. So it all depends on the agency. This woman I talked to was with Army. So go Army. They were real quick about it.
Great. Now, in the reverse, somebody that knows they have some issues in the past, could be a divorce, it could be not divorce, but marriage midway through the career. Are there any things that they can do to help speed the process?
Well, I'd say if you've been divorced, the only thing that OPM really needs to see is if any of that retirement benefit, whether it be civil service or FERS, or a survivor benefit was awarded to your former spouse. So if there's nothing in the divorce decree that says anything about CSRS or FERS, OPM doesn't necessarily have to see the divorce decree. And that's going to save some time there, because if they see that divorce decree come in, even if it doesn't mention CSRS or FERS, they still send the whole thing to court order. So therefore, if you've been divorced, maybe even before your federal career started, or if you just said, you keep your retirement, I'll keep mine, and nothing is mentioned in the divorce decree, you don't have to include it. And that could save you some time right there. Marriages usually don't delay the whole thing unless you got married the week before you retired, perhaps. Then you got to, I'd say get married after you retire if you're trying to decide when.
All righty. And then once it leaves the agency, it goes to OPM, and they have to go to the cave, if you will, right, to extract really old documents. Is that accurate?
Well, what happens is OPM gets your case in Washington, and they kind of triage it to figure out how complicated it is, where does it need to go besides just to a claims examiner. Most of the work is done in Boyers, Pennsylvania, so as you call it, the cave. It's an underground storage facility where they keep records back to Abraham Lincoln and Civil War and probably before that. So there's all kinds of records stored in that climate-controlled location. So if you have records from prior service that you've had, or maybe you took a refund of retirement contributions, they may have to go back in the cave and pull some of those records out of storage. You can save some time if you have those records at home and you include a copy. So it makes it easier to know where to look for them, and they may not even have to pull them out if you send adequate documentation. So I always tell employees, if you know you've done something, if it's not properly accounted for in your personnel folder, but you have the records at home, make sure you make copies of that and show it to your human resource office, and that's something that possibly should go with your retirement case, even if it was never included in your personnel file before. So.
Okay. We actually have a question similar to what we're just talking about, but it goes beyond the retirement date. And actually, we've got three questions from this person who's generally gives us very good questions. And here we go. What needs to be taken in consideration when a federal employee is contemplating moving, but more importantly, outside the U.S.? In this case, the question was in Spain. What concerns are there for health insurance, taxes on the TSP, FERS annuity, CSRS annuity? Roth IRAs, probably not an issue.
Yeah, I'm glad you're going to answer this, Bob, because this comes up a lot in class, and I'm hoping you've got some good answers. The only one I could address there might be health insurance, but I'm real curious to see if somebody did move. You know, I've heard a lot of people moving to Costa Rica, to Belize, you know, different island locations where it's a lot less expensive and beautiful to live there. So Spain would be another nice location. Maybe some people have family overseas. So what are the tax implications? What are the things people need to be concerned about or do if they're making that kind of move?
Let me answer it, but I'm just going to do a little plug for a prior show. There's no commercials on this, but it was two tax attorneys, and a very good show. Spoke normal English, talked about normal things, but we went the whole show on this. Okay, but let me directly answer the question. A U.S. citizen, regardless of where they live in the world, they will pay tax to the United States government. Okay, that's just going to be the case.
Even if they have dual citizenship?
Okay. Yeah, that even gets rougher.
Okay.
Dual citizenship could mean two
pay taxes to both countries.
Yeah. But one offsets the other. in most cases, most countries, if you will, popular destinations, have an agreement between the U.S. If you pay tax in one place, you don't pay tax in both, you get what's called a foreign tax credit. Maybe some of the listeners can remember this on their own return. They might have an interest in a mutual fund, and that mutual fund invests in foreign countries, companies in foreign countries. And some of the profits, or the dividends in that case, have foreign taxes withheld. So on the annual statement that a shareholder has in this mutual fund, there's this thing called a foreign tax credit. And that's what it is. And it reduces the U.S. tax because it was paid to, again, a friendly nation. They're not all like this, right, but I would say the bulk of them. So let's go back to your very good question. Somebody moves to Costa Rica. Somebody moves to Spain. They're going to pay taxes to the U.S. Now, the question is, when they leave, do they take the state of residence with them from the United States? And the answer is yes. So if somebody moves from a state that would follow you to the foreign country, you're going to pay both federal and state taxes.
Is that all states do
that? Not all states are like that. I would say more than not, but not all. Certainly the states, somebody would say, well, I'll move to a state with no state income tax, Florida, Texas, Washington State, et cetera, and then I'll make my move. Good move. Then nobody's going to follow you.
Okay.
You don't necessarily want to get caught by saying I lived there for 3 days and then I moved. So you'd want to establish the legal residency. Now, from what I understand,
that's true. Even if you give up your home, and like if I moved from Virginia to Costa Rica and I sold my house and completely moved, I'd still have to pay Virginia state income tax.
If you move while a Virginia resident, you're a citizen of the U.S. In order to be one, you have to have a state of residence.
Okay.
Even though you might not go there anymore.
Even though I don't have a house
you left,
there.
You left. Okay. Now, some states are not. For your question is good. Virginia would follow you. Maryland would follow you. Mm-hmm. But let's take Georgia, for example. They are the mirror image of paying taxes in Georgia, what they do in Maryland or Virginia. But Georgia said, listen, if you leave and you never want to come back or never have a desire to come back, we won't follow you.
Oh, good.
So you would just have to look at the state you were in,
the state rules,
or if you were going to move to one of these tax attractive states.
Interesting.
Okay. Now, then the question would be, will the new country want to tax your U.S. annuity? I don't know the answer to that. Now, different countries will, even though they're friendly.
Yeah.
So you could have a double tax, but remember, you can't have a double tax. So, and I'm not saying the listeners should not hear this, that you will pay tax on your annuity in the foreign country. But let's just say you do, you'll get a foreign tax credit against it at the federal level.
US.
So you're really not going to pay taxes
full double.
But let's say the foreign country's tax is greater than the U.S. tax. They're not going to give you credit for that.
No, so you'll just pay the higher tax.
Yeah.
Interesting. I've wondered about that. The same. How about with your TSP distributions in a foreign country? So it'd be the same thing.
Generally speaking, they're not going to be taxed. But again, you might
have a
foreign country.
But you'd pay the U.S.
country.
Tax.
Oh, yeah.
Your state of residence, last state of residence.
There'd be no difference, except you just live in a foreign country. Your U.S. tax return is going to be no different than what it was before you moved.
Interesting. So you can't get away from your federal taxes unless you give up residency.
Yeah, that's a high price to pay.
Give up citizenship.
Yes, and we saw that in the news 6 months ago or so. These were uber-rich people, mm-hmm. but they decided to renounce their U.S. citizenship. So that they wouldn't have to pay federal income taxes on it. It's a personal decision.
Yes,
but
that's one way around it.
That's one way around it. But
most federal employees, I don't see doing that.
I don't see that either. No. And what they left out of that is, let's say that somebody is not a U.S. citizen, never was a U.S. citizen, but has earnings in the U.S. Well, the U.S. is going to want to tax them.
Right. Well, with health insurance, because a lot of people ask about health insurance and Medicare. Medicare is only in the U.S., so if you move to Belize or Spain or anywhere in the world, you won't be able to use your Medicare benefits. But if you have Blue Cross Federal or if you have SAMBA, any of the fee-for-service plans that aren't linked to a regional area, you can use those around the world. In fact, some of the plans, like Blue Cross, have offices overseas because we have so many federal employees who work in overseas locations that they've made it easier by establishing some overseas service centers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, health insurance you'll still have. Medicare, no, but you can still certainly keep your federal health benefits.
Alrighty, besides our radio show, there was a very good article. It was about 5 or 6 months ago, and you know the guy's name better than I do that works for NARF. I kind of know his last name, but I'll butcher it.
Tobikin.
That's it. Yeah. Thank you. And he wrote a really outstanding article, quoted you, quoted me, but he also brought up some realistic factors that the listeners, I'm sure, have heard about the IRS's push to find foreign bank accounts of U.S. citizens that weren't paying taxes on it. Now, with that push, they got fairly pushy with the foreign banks, such that a number of the foreign banks don't want to deal with U.S. citizens because they bring in with them the Trojan horse of the IRS. So they just go, I don't want to deal with it. And he mentioned it in the article. Sometimes it's not the easiest to find a bank, and probably what you would have to do is find a multinational bank, whatever that might be.
Yeah. What about your direct deposits and banking checks and so forth? Do a lot of foreign or U.S. citizens who move to foreign countries, they would probably just do direct deposit in a U.S. bank?
Right,
and
again, one of these multinational banks, and that would work, but it's not going to get direct deposited to a non-multinational bank.
Right, or just keep your U.S. bank account.
Yeah.
And just do direct deposit or pay with check or electronic banking. That's one good thing about the internet, has made this a much smaller world when it comes to moving around worldwide, not just across the country.
Yeah.
And we're seeing more of that. Okay, so I think that covers his overseas questions, I think.
It did.
All right.
But then I believe I've got one that parallels this, but it's not necessarily for somebody offshore.
Mm-hmm.
When and why are distributions from the TSP and or a traditional IRA required to be taken? Is there a way to prevent this? Okay, now, what they call it affectionately is RMD, required minimum distribution. Some people would call it required mandatory distribution. Call it what you want at age 70 and a half, and then somebody's going to say, where do they get these half numbers? My response would be, I don't know, but it's most likely compromised somewhere. Okay, so picture now what's inside of your TSP, your traditional TSP, or traditional IRA, not the Roth. That money's never been taxed. And at 70 and a half, Congress, and let's take the sugar coating off of it. They look at somebody 70 and a half that's never paid tax on these investments, and they say to themselves, we better get them before they go, not leave the country, leave the earth. So they're 70 and a half, and it's a required distribution so that they at least can tax some of it,
right,
maybe all of it, but the spread is extremely long. It starts at 70 and a half, and it keeps going to 117 and years later.
Right. So the key word there is minimum distribution.
It's minimum for about 10, 12 years. It is a small percentage.
Mm-hmm.
But as, remember, it's based on a life expectancy. So as the life expectancy shortens,
the number you divide by gets smaller.
That's right, which means you pay more in taxes. And
right,
that's the concept of it. And there's no way around it other than this. But somebody would have to stay on the job after 70 and a half. With regards to a traditional IRA, if somebody is working for Uncle and they're older than 70 and a half, they would be required to take a mandatory distribution from their traditional IRA. However, one of the options with the thrift is to move money from a traditional IRA, and I might add only the taxable portion, into the thrift. And as long as they stay on the job, there's no mandatory distribution on that money moved over, because there's no distribution required from the thrift until they retire.
So you're saying just work till you're 96 and you don't have to pay the tax on it.
Thank you, Tammy. That's what I planned on doing.
Not so sure I like that idea.
No, I think I'd have to agree with you.
Because some people have asked, could they take money out and give it away, like to a charity? Things like that. So could you take distributions from your TSP and donate it to avoid the tax?
Yes, and up until a point, you could put a lot of money and it just goes in and out. And that provision, let's say that provision goes away, because it can be a dollar and it can be up to $100,000. Most of most people are not going to donate $100,000 at a time. They might do it after they pass, but
right,
they're not going to do it while they need the money. But let's say that provision couldn't go directly from the investment to the charity. The worst case would be it would go to the individual, and then they would donate the money. So it takes an indirect route to the charity, and then would be claimed as a charitable donation on their personal return.
Right.
The question you were asking me about is good. It never hits the tax return.
Right. So if you normally give $1,000 a month to whatever charity, then that would be $12,000 a year that you could pretty much consider a wash from your distribution from your retirement account. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the TSP would let you transfer the money directly to the charity so that you never had to get the right. W-2 or the 1099
form. So you could transfer to an IRA, move it out of the IRA into your own, and then it would be...
Oh, that's
it
true.
It wouldn't be a direct. It would be an indirect. There's some issues with distributions from IRAs being limited, but, you know.
There's also limits on the TSP. If you want to move money directly from the TSP to an IRA, you can do that with a monthly payment, but you have to deplete the account within 10 years.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you have to take the distribution yourself. So for people who are listening who want to know more about TSP distributions and taxes on TSP distributions, I would suggest starting with the two TSP publications. The first one is Withdrawing Your TSP Account After Leaving Federal Service, and the other one is called Important Tax Information About Your TSP Distributions. Both of those are on TSP.gov under Forms and Publications. Beyond that, there's probably some tax IRS publications you could also refer to.
Yes, one of them is it's IRS Publication 760. It's wholly devoted to IRAs. It's pretty thick.
Does it include TSP in there?
No. No, but that would be included in a catch-all talking about distributions from retirement plans, not IRAs.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a 401k plan, or somebody has a small business and they have a self-employed retirement plan, et cetera. The concept isn't much different than the IRA.
Right.
Now, there's one thing, and I'm glad you mentioned this about the TSP. There's a feeling, and we've asked the good folks from the Thrift when they come on this show if you can do this. And there are a number of people, I would say more so than not, feel that you can only take one partial distribution from the Thrift your entire life. No. And with regards to the Thrift, if one is retired, they can elect monthly distributions. Now, there's two types. We're going to talk about the one where you tell them what you want, and once a year you can change your mind. And if you set that at the absolute minimum, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is $25 a month?
That's right.
Okay, now that's $300 a year, so that's not going to skew anybody's tax return. But what it allows somebody to do is annually to say, I'll increase that or decrease that, not below the 25,
right,
for what I might need. So this... somebody's got to be very clairvoyant here to say, I'm going to need $10,000 next year. So in December, they jack the payment up to $833. They get their $10,000 at the end of the year. They bring it back down to $25.
Right.
So you can do that.
Yeah, that's called a monthly distribution where it's a set dollar amount. So you're telling the TSP, as you said, how many dollars you want each month. Right now, it's restricted to once a year. Possibly in the future, you might see the TSP will liberalize that to more often. But for right now, you can only make that change at the end of the year for the upcoming year.
Yes. And the folks from TSP, when they've been on the show, they've mentioned it. But they've always kind of said, you just don't go to Congress with one thing and say, can I do this?
Right.
No, because they have to have authorization, if you will, to do
and
it.
And also study the cost of it. How would that impact the administrative expenses if you do it more often? The other thing on that same option is we were talking about the required or minimum distributions, or required mandatory minimum distributions. If you set it up that you want to take $25 a month out, let's say you didn't really want to take money out of your thrift, but you have that monthly payment going. Once you hit 70 and a half and you're then going to face that required distribution, which obviously for most people today would mean you have to take more than $25 a month. But even if you set it at that low level, at the end of the year, the TSP would send you a supplement, which would be a lump sum payment of that required amount. So that would be one way to avoid any tax penalties for not taking your distribution. So for someone who leaves their money in the thrift, that would be an easy way to make sure you're meeting that required distribution amount.
I'm glad you said tax penalties, because some people say, well, they'll come get me. Well, if they come get you, you won't like what they're going to bring. They're going to bring
the
a 6% per annum assessment of 6%.
And if you forgot for 10 years, that adds up.
Yeah. Yeah. Now it's 6% of the amount of money you should have taken out, not 6% of your entire pot. But nonetheless, like you're right, if a number of years, or somebody just forgets or didn't know.
Well, you know, some of you may have parents or other relatives who had TSP. Maybe they worked for the government 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but the TSP is now almost 27 years old. And they may have money in the thrift that they just kind of forgot about. You know, maybe it wasn't a ton of money. Maybe it was like, you know, $5,000. And if they're over 70 and a half, if they haven't kept their address current with the thrift, they never got the notice that said you're facing required minimum distribution. So if you or you know somebody who might have money in there, it might pay you to update your address with the TSP and find out if you're in a position where you may have should have been taking out those distributions.
And as well with their IRAs.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. The
you're
onus
not excused
is initially
by ignorance.
On the organization, whether it's a TSP or the IRA, to contact the person. But if they can't contact them because they have bad info.
Right. I say that because the TSP every year sends out thousands of notifications telling people that you're going to face this distribution next year. And they say they get almost half of those back returned to sender.
Really?
Yep.
Okay, with all this, somebody might say, I don't want to go into retirement. When is phased retirement going to be available?
Yeah, that's the thing. The law for phased retirement passed in 2012, I think it was. So it's almost 2 years old, this new provision of the law that will allow federal employees, not all, but some federal employees, to ease into retirement. It's called phased retirement. So every time I teach a class, somebody always asks me about this. You know, when can we do it? We haven't heard about it. Well, what we're waiting for now, the rules went out for comment in the Federal Register last summer. The comment period ended in August of last year. So OPM received, I guess, literally hundreds, if not maybe thousands of comments from agencies and individuals, you know, saying, how's this going to work or how's this going to impact something else? So they're responding to that by really studying this legislation before they make it available. So hopefully it's going to be this year sometime, as I've heard, sometime in 2014. It could be March, it could be December, so we still don't know. But I think we have a call, so after the call, I'll talk more about it.
No,
we don't have a call.
Andrew just waved it off.
Okay, well, let me just say a couple more things, just in general, about what phased retirement is, what we do know about it. When it does become available, an employee has to be eligible to retire. So it's somebody who's maybe in their 50s or 60s, and they've got 30 years, or maybe they're 60 with 20 years. So they're eligible to collect an immediate retirement. They're already old enough and have enough service to retire. But, you know, even though they might be financially ready to retire, they have enough money to pay their bills with their retirement, maybe emotionally or mentally they're not ready. Maybe they love their job. You know, who figures, you know, somebody loves their job. So they love their job. They want to keep in the work that they're doing, maybe finish a project, maybe just continue doing that work, just not doing it full time. So they'll be able to retire on Friday, collect half of their retirement that they've earned, and then come back to work on Monday, working 20 hours a week instead of 40. So at the end of that phased retirement period, whether it goes on for a year, whether it goes on for 5 or 10 years, they would have additional retirement that they've accumulated from those 20 hours a week they've been working. And at that point, they would get their 100% retirement, their full retirement at the end of that phased period. So it's going to have to be determined what period that is. Is it going to be at the employee's discretion to determine when they want to finish phased retirement? Will the agency set a limit for you to say you can only do this for 2 years or 5 years? So some of those details are yet to be worked out. But those people who are in that provision would be still employees. They could still contribute to the thrift. They would still have their health insurance through their salary. So it's a very interesting proposition.
Okay. Thank you. And we have a caller on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I love the show. It's greatly informative. You can't get this anyplace else. But
well, thank you.
You're welcome. I hear Tammy talking. I heard just a few minutes ago speaking about the monthly distributions from your TSP.
Right.
And hi, Tammy.
Hi.
I wanted to ask. I plan on retiring this January 2nd, 2015. Now, should I have submitted my monthly contribution for my TSP earlier, like during open season, or am I still allowed, being I'm retiring in January, am I allowed to submit my form then?
Oh, okay. Good question. So you're wondering about the timing of when to apply to take that distribution.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So if you wanted to start receiving those payments directly after you retire, the problem is the TSP won't pay you a distribution until your agency has told them that you've separated the agency. So we always tell employees to wait 30 days. So if you're going to retire January 2nd, 2015, I'd probably wait till at least February 1st to apply for a distribution from the thrift. Give it a month so that your agency sends down the separation notice to the TSP Record Center. And that way, when your application comes in that you want to apply to start taking a monthly payment, they'll already know that you've left the agency. And then they'll start the payments within, usually within 2 weeks of your request. So, and you'll get the payments, I believe it's around the first of each month if you're going to take a monthly payment.
So I just want to be positive about what you're saying. It's best to wait 30 days, so don't even submit the form to like February 2nd.
That's right. Yeah, that's kind of counterintuitive because I just got done saying put in your civil service or FERS retirement application 60 days, maybe even 90 days before you retire because the agency has work to do on that. But your TSP application, that's going to be directly between you and the thrift. It's like you're going to the bank to make a withdrawal, so you don't have to get your agency involved in that. So you'd be applying directly to the TSP. You can do it 30 days after you retire. If you want to wait for the dust to settle and wait 6 months, you could wait 6 months. There's no specific time other than if you're over 70 and a half, then you'll have to do it April. What is it, Bob? April of the year after you retire?
Yes.
If you're past 70 and a half?
Yes.
So if he was to retire, he or she was to retire January 2nd, would they have until April of the following year, 2016, to make that election?
If they left in that year, yes. But if they push that back, then they have two distributions in the following year, one by April 15th and the other one by December 31st. If they decide, I'm not going to take my, and they have the first year option, not to take my mandatory distribution this year, they can do it, but they would have to take that distribution no later than April 15th. But because they're really required then to take a distribution in the next year, then that has to be done by the same year, but December 31st.
Well, then that brings, excuse me, caller, I have one more question for Bob.
I'm listening.
Yeah, the other question I have for Bob would be, okay, so April 1st, you say, okay, I'm going to start my distribution this year because I'm past 70 and a half, and then you say I have to take a second, but what if I'm doing a monthly payout where I'm having it calculated based on my life expectancy? That would meet that, wouldn't it?
That would meet it if they took it in that year. That would be saying, okay, I have to take it. I'll take it in this year based on a monthly distribution, but it still has to equal X.
Okay. All right.
And what is X? Roughly speaking, in the first year, it's 3.65% of what's in your traditional IRA, not your Roth.
And your TSP.
And your TSP, but also the Roth TSP. The Roth TSP doesn't get the same ride as a Roth IRA.
Okay, so you still have to take distribution of your Roth TSP unless you move it out of the TSP.
Got it.
Okay, good. Hey, does that answer your question, caller?
Yes, it does. I have one last quick question, if I may.
Sure.
Which form would I use for the monthly contribution? Is it the TSP 73 or 77? Do you know?
It's the TSP 70. The TSP 70 is the full distribution form. The TSP 77 is only for a partial distribution.
Well, this is what I'm asking. I want to get monthly payments.
Yeah, it's the 70.
So it is the 70.
That's right. That's the only one that lets you elect a monthly distribution. The other thing you can do if you wanted to simplify things is they have a, I forget what they call it, but it's on TSP.gov. If you access your account, you can do the application online. And it's almost like it's a wizard. That's what they call it, a wizard. Mm. So they'll only ask you the questions that that you need to be asked. So it kind of eliminates some of the guesswork when filling out that form, because that form has gotten quite complicated with the Roth TSP being implemented. It used to just be a 2-page form. Now it's about 16 pages. So I would say if you can use the online application, it might be simplified for you, possibly. So either way, but you can do the 70 and mail it in, or you can do the online application and have it maybe be a little easier.
And it would be under TSP withdrawals?
Well, it'd be under your account. So when you go to TSP.gov, you have to have an account set up. So if you set up your account there where you can access your TSP balance and your...
I have that, yes.
Yeah, so you go in there and that's where you'd make your election for withdrawal.
Okay, that sounds really good. Okay. I apologize, could I ask one more question?
Sure, go ahead, real quick. Go ahead.
Okay, real quick. Any idea what the taxes on our annuity would be?
Well, I'd have to ask you something, and then you'd probably shoot me. It depends on your...
No way.
It would depend on your taxable income.
And but it's just ordinary tax, right? A lot of people think it's...
Yeah, right. Yes. You don't get any capital gain. You don't get any dividend. You pay regular tax. I don't want to even remotely suggest that I'm going to ask you this, because I'm not. But let me ask you this. Do you file a return jointly or single, or how do you file?
I filed jointly. I went on OPM. They set up the 32,000. I think I read it correctly.
Whatever they withhold doesn't mean that's the tax you're going to pay. So most likely what they will withhold is going to be less than the tax you're going to pay. As an individual taxpayer, everybody listening, everybody in the studio, everybody on the other end of this mic, we all pay taxes the same way. It's the aggregate of all the money that we get, whether it's from the TSP, whether it's from Social Security, whether it's from your annuity. There's a taxable portion of each. It's all added together. And it's like walking upstairs. So I'd imagine that, I'm just going to shoot this out, that if your taxable income, now this is all your income minus your tax, is between, I'm going to use round numbers, $18,000 and $74,000, any money that's in there is going to get taxed at a flat 15% plus your state bracket. If your income is above $74,000 but less than $149,000, again, this is taxable, then your federal tax is 25%. It's immaterial what they withhold.
But this just is, on that portion above 74,000.
You got it.
Right.
Right. Plus your state now. Don't forget your state bracket.
Well, I was just going to comment real quick. The New York State, I believe, do not charge the government pensions.
Well, they don't tax the pension, but they tax everything else that moves.
Your TSP distribution would be taxed. Because the TSP is not considered part of your government pension.
Right.
Correct.
Yep.
I greatly appreciate your help, and I think it's a great show. You guys have a wonderful day.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All righty. This is a good call, so let's take a tangent. And actually, it was one of the talking points. Our president announced in the State of the Union that there was going to be a new type of IRA. It was officially going to be
My-RA.
My-R-A. All right.
Not I.
Myra. So let's talk about Myra. Okay, so a Myra
is... Because he even got tripped up on it. That's what I said, because he was trying to say my IRA, and it's my RA.
Right.
My RA. It's kind of catchy.
Yeah, it is. And so, I mean, it's something, and what I liked about the name anyway, somebody would go, oh, yeah, that's new. That's, you know, what's jazzy about it. Now, what it is, it's not an IRA, it's a Roth IRA. So if you put money into this... First of all, this should not be hard for most people. The total income can't exceed $191,000 a year. So it allows
people... So it's going to have the same income restrictions.
Exactly.
So some people won't be able to do a MyRA.
Right.
Okay.
Now, the most that you can put in parallels what you could put into a traditional IRA annually. $5,500 if they're not 50, and $6,500 if they are. But it goes into an account, and there's some misunderstanding that it goes into the G fund. It doesn't go anywhere near the G fund. What the similarity is, it's invested in government bonds, and in this case, they are not subject to market whims, so you can't lose principal. Government bonds can be subject to market whims.
Right, so this is very similar to the G fund, but for federal employees who are concerned about their G fund being affected, this is not going to be anything going into your G fund.
Right.
They're going to set up a separate contract
for
someone to manage
this.
It's
as far away from the thrift account right. as one could get.
It's the same concept. You
same
won't have
concept,
a negative return.
Same guarantee. Mm-hmm. Now, the rate of return is going to be similar to the G fund rate of return. There's nothing wrong with it, but, you know, it's not going to set the world on fire unless inflation goes crazy.
Right.
And so I'm not speaking negatively. The most you can accumulate in this is $15,000. So once it hits $15,000, it's got to go to a traditional, a traditional or a Roth. Why would you ever put it into a traditional? It would go to a Roth IRA.
So you can transfer it to a Roth.
Yeah.
And then just do regular Roth contributions after that.
Assuming you meet the income requirement.
Right.
So who is this attractive? It would be attractive for somebody maybe of modest means, somebody just starting a federal career. Their income is going to be below that. It's just a great deal in their case because it'll sit there for 30 years.
But why not just do the thrift?
Okay, well, you would want to do the thrift first, I think. Maybe not when you're first working, because you're never going to be in a lower tax bracket than when you first work. And so if you can get money into a Roth, whether it's a Roth TSP or a Roth IRA.
Well, the Roth TSP, you get matching.
And you get a ton more, right?
Yeah. So I think so if you're only going to invest 5% of your pay, put it in a thrift.
Oh, no question. Right,
yeah,
right.
Okay. So don't misunderstand us. We're not saying do the MyRA instead of the thrift.
Oh, no.
It would be in addition to.
But there might be some people that the people listening will talk to. Remember, they're not in the same world you are, and this is what it's designed for, people that aren't covered under a company plan, who don't get automatic
withdrawals. Someone who works for maybe a small business that doesn't offer an IRA.
I was surprised at the stats. Mm-hmm. 75 million workers don't have the ability to do this.
Mm-hmm. Now, and the other thing with a MyRA, that what you can invest is much lower than some other plans. I think you can start with as little as $50.
And there's no administrative fees.
Right.
So you're right. It's going to be very attractive to...
I don't think it's going to go very far in supporting someone in retirement. But I think what's good about it, it gets someone the thought, the idea, the feeling of being able to save for retirement with that purpose in mind. So as time goes by and hopefully they get pay increases... they can move forward. So it gets you started. It's better than nothing.
Right. So that's a quick introductory. I'm going to put two of your bullet points together, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay. One of it, how many TSP millionaires are there, and why am I not one of them?
Well, first of all, there's over 4.6, almost 4.7 million TSP participants. This includes federal employees, retirees, separated employees, military personnel. So the TSP is huge, you know, almost 4.7 million people. Of that group, there's less than 1,700 who have $1 million balance or more. In fact, 98% of all TSP participants have less than 500,000. So if you're not one of the TSP millionaires, I'm not surprised. There's very few of them out there. But there are starting to be more than I would have expected. You know, there's starting to be some people who are true TSP millionaires. People who started in 1987 with whatever they were putting in the GC and the F fund, which is all we had back then, and who've consistently been saving and managing that account and taking a little bit of risk, because you're not going to get there with the G fund 100%. And they now have $1 million+. And some of them are starting to retire with that nice supplement to their FERS retirement benefit. So these are FERS employees who have $1 million accounts.
I'm glad you brought that up, because sometimes when it comes up in class, people go, well, I'm never going to, and you have to tell them most of the people that are in this club brought the money in from somewhere else. They brought a 401k from a prior employer, or you see some of the in academia, they'll bring in their 453 whatevers,
right,
and they'll transfer that in there and they get a leg up. But also, like you say, now the homegrown TSP folks are starting to join the club.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think last year really helped because the stock market had an overall over 25% return. So if you were all C and S fund last year, even some I fund money, you did really well. So that would have pushed you over that edge if you were getting close. So I think we're going to see more of those if the market continues to grow. But if we have another correction, you know, hopefully not as bad as 2008, some of those folks might dip below the million. So the question becomes then, when you move into retirement, because this one guy who's in that club is retiring this month, and his distribution, he sent me his latest statement, it's 50% C, 50% S.
Really?
Going into retirement.
So really covered the U.S. base, huh?
Yeah, but he has nothing in G, right, and nothing anywhere else, so... to me, that's a little risky. What do you think?
Well,
if that's his only money.
I was born under the cautious sign, but that's why I'll never have what your friend asked.
Well, that's who am I to judge? He's got $1 million. So hopefully he keeps it and keeps it growing. So hope it does.
All righty. The other Tammy question, why do I need to take Medicare B when I turn 65?
Yeah,
that's probably a whole show.
Oh, man. When I go to, I am a member of NARF, you know, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, and I go to my monthly meetings when I'm off on a Thursday, because they hold our chapter meetings on Thursday afternoons, and it never fails. Every month somebody asks about Medicare Part B, or they have a comment, or they have an opinion about Medicare Part B. And, you know, I meet these folks who are just turning 65, or they turn 65 within the last 5 years. And they're very healthy. They're still traveling. They're still doing all the things they did when they were 55. So obviously, they're not using a lot of health care. So their opinion about Medicare Part B is they don't need it. They're like Blue Cross or Samba or Kaiser. They've served me well throughout my federal career. I plan to use those for the rest of my life. And those will cover you for the rest of your life. Your federal health insurance will continue on until the day you die. However, when you turn 65, all federal employees now pay into Medicare. The tax that you pay is for Medicare Part A. It's the hospital insurance. And most people won't argue that they should take Medicare Part A because it's free. You've already paid the tax. But it's only going to cover you when the doctor says you have to spend the night. So it's going to cover your room and board, your nursing fees, all the inpatient expenses. Medicare Part B is the one that people question because there's a premium. So when you're 65, you have to pay a premium of at least $105 a month, $104.96. So you pay that premium, and if you have higher income, and a lot of our retirees do hit the threshold where they're going to pay higher Medicare premium, so it might be $146 a month, or it could be as high as $300 a month. Now we're talking real money. It's like, you know, why would I want to pay that when Blue Cross and Samba and Kaiser and all the other federal health plans, they don't lower my premium when Medicare takes over, so why would I want to do that? Well, here's the thing, and this is the true with any insurance. We all buy insurance and we all hope we never get our money's worth out of it. But healthcare is something that I think as we get older, we might need more of it. You know, most of us will probably have some chronic illnesses if we're lucky enough to live long enough. We might need some expensive medical treatment. We might need some skilled nursing care. We might need durable medical equipment. And when you start to look at the co-insurance and the co-pays and the deductibles that you pay with your health insurance when you're sick, when you're starting to schedule your social life around your doctor visits, that can add up to more than $105 a month. That could add up to more than $300 a month. And you don't realize that when you're healthy. So I would just caution people that don't think about Medicare how it is when you feel when you're 65. Think about how it's going to be when you're 75, 85, and 95. You might live that long, but how's your health going to be? Won't you be glad to have a budget on your healthcare expenses? Won't you be glad to be able to go to any doctor in the country and have Medicare pay first, your federal plan pay second, and all you have to pay is that Part B premium and your FEHB premium? If you like that idea of having that known amount of money that you have to spend on healthcare, that's why I would say consider Part B. I mean, it's your option because the federal plans will cover you even if you don't take it. But I think it's a risky proposition. I think you could end up with meeting your catastrophic expenses more years than not if you're not in the best of health when you get older. And those catastrophic limits can be $5,000, $6,000, sometimes $10,000, $12,000 a year.
And the penalty, I just had one a week or two ago, and it was $180 a month.
Mm-hmm.
That was the penalty, and
yeah,
somebody didn't elect when they should have.
Well, the penalty is 10% for every 12 months that you delay enrollment. So if you just wait 10 years, I'll just wait till I'm 75 and take it, well, you're going to pay double what everybody else is paying for the rest of your life. So it's a catch-22, and I'll admit that when you first become eligible, you can't justify it, especially if you're healthy. But as time goes by, keep in mind your health may take a turn that needs a little bit more care, a little bit more attention, a little bit more expensive medical treatment. And that's when Medicare is going to be something you're glad you have.
Okay.
So that's all I can say. I can't tell you you have to take it because you don't, but I would strongly urge you to consider it.
Okay. I got a question here. Why is some of the information necessary to complete my current year's tax return coming so late this year? And the answer is pretty much it's investment type income if you have a mutual fund or a broker statement or something like that, that over the last couple of years, because of the changes in the tax law, the things that have to be reported on there get into the weeds. And they used to say, well, you have to have this by January 31st. Well, they couldn't get the information by January 31st, so somebody that had this would get a statement. It would be incorrect, then it would be corrected again, then it would be corrected a second time. And so it just made sense to say, why don't we do it once and do it right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the forms aren't necessary.
Is there a later deadline for people to send out those forms?
If I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but does that also delay when we have to file our returns past April 15th?
Of course
can we
not.
Wait till May 31st now?
You can wait, but you can file an extension.
But they have not changed the April 15th date.
No.
That's still,
and actually,
it's not leap year, no special year.
If they were ever going to do it, I thought it was going to be this year because of things.
The budget,
but
everything going on.
I think if they do it, then they could put their toe in the water and maybe they could do it again. I mean, it's just ingrained in people's head, April 15th, and I can file an extension, and that's why they do it.
And I don't know if you're like us, you know, we got everything together. We're ready to go. We just can't submit it yet. So, you know, we're just waiting for maybe one more form or one more thing to come in. So you can still start working on your taxes if you're a do-it-yourselfer. But
I'm a do-it-myselfer, but mine due date is October 15th.
I would hope you don't hire someone to do your taxes.
That's the least attractive tax return I have to do. I just don't like it. But I like doing other people's and trying to explain it. I can't explain it to myself.
I know. Just like retirement. I like retiring other people. Thinking about it myself is a little scary.
Well, you and I will probably work a good number of years more.
Yeah. Alrighty. It's not work, right? We just like it.
Yeah, this is fun. All righty, Tammy, your side of the fence. What should I think about if I am thinking about resigning from federal service?
Yeah. I don't know. I get this question a lot, probably because we're teaching more mid-career planning classes and new employee classes where you'll have somebody fairly new or maybe 10 or 15, even 20 years into their federal career. And of course, you start to get that 10-year itch. Like, okay, you know, is this all there is? You know, I hadn't got a pay raise for 3 years. You know, the promotions are fewer and farther between, or I'm topped out at what I can do here in my current position. So you start to think that maybe I should just go into the private sector. Maybe I'll just, you know, call it a day with the federal government, go move into private industry, and, you know, they got to pay more, they got to provide better benefits, you know, whatever. Don't be so sure, especially these days, you know, with pensions becoming more scarce and with benefits sometimes at the mercy of the bottom line in the private sector. Don't always be thinking that it's going to be a better position. Really be careful to understand what you're giving up and know what you're going to gain before you leave, because your salary in the government's just part of it. You know, you might make $100,000. You know, so you might be lucky enough to have a six-figure salary, but on top of that, you have a pension benefit. It's costing your agency about 15% of payroll just for the FERS basic benefit. On top of that, you have the thrift savings plan that matches you 5%. You put in 5, they put in 5. You don't have to do anything else. And you have a very low administrative expense ratio, so you can save for your retirement very easily within the thrift. So those two things right there, let alone the leave, the family-friendly policies, the flexible work schedules, the 9-to-5, you know, not the 9-to-7, so really think carefully before you jump ship, because leaving federal service is real easy. Getting back in could be another story.
That's right. That's right. And the other benefits, too, the training you can get. I'm not talking about retirement training, but, you know, professional training. It's unparalleled.
Well, every job that's in the private sector is in the government. Whether you want to be a doctor, a nuclear scientist, whether you want to work for DOD, whether you want to work for Commerce. So those benefits follow you. So if you don't like what you're doing right now, go to usajobs.gov and see what else is out there. But your benefits will continue to accrue. And I think there's something to be said for the benefit package that federal employees do have.
Okay, the benefits to listening to this show are about to be cut off.
Uh-oh.
Andrew is saying, hurry up, you two. Anyway, final comments, Tammy?
As I always say, just keep learning and stay prepared and don't expect someone else to do it for you.
All righty. Thanks for listening. We'll be on next week. We'll be talking finances with Karen Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Government Cloud Brokerage. Who, what, when, where, why? Panel sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Featuring a group of government and industry leaders discussing the growing complexity of cloud computing infrastructure and how agencies are evaluating and acquiring cloud brokers. To listen to the entire panel program, go to federalnewsradio.com. Or to learn more, go to gdit.com/cloudbroker.